In the news.
Good morning, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Politics.
Well, another interesting week, middle of the summer. Seems like we're kind of slogging along. Yes. Taking any vacations this summer?
Short trips here and there.
Yeah, we're sort of, you know, I got three kids and they're all at home and they're all kind of doing different things. So we're not doing any long trips, that's for sure. But hopefully get to the coast or something. So, okay, a few things in the news this week. Once again, the Affordable Care Act is in the news. The Republican attempts to repeal and replace or repeal or replace or something came to fruition. So let's start there. Professor McDaniel, what do you think about this?
So, again, it's been really slow going. There was an attempt to completely overhaul it. That failed. Now we moved into basically having a reconciliation conference, and there was this really intense fight to whether or not they would actually be open for debate. And so yesterday, the Senate met to have that vote. It was delayed because Senator John McCain of Arizona, many of you may remember when he ran for president in 2008, he was diagnosed with brain cancer. And so because of this, a number of health issues, he returned to Capitol Hill yesterday for this vote. And again, this is very important for Majority Leader Senator Mitch McConnell, because this is part of his legacy of pushing this through. And it did pass by a vote of 50 to 51. Now, again, you may be wondering, wait a second, aren't there 100 members of the Senate? You are correct. However, there's also the president of the Senate, and that would be Vice President Mike Pence. And so he was the deciding vote, much like in the case, I think Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, it was 50 to 51. He had to cast his vote in order to break the tie.
Yeah, so, you know, this is not unusual. Certainly in recent years, it's been fairly common. As Professor McDaniel said, you know, the Vice President of the United States is the President of the Senate. He or she, it's been he for the most part, does not have votes unless it's a tiebreaker, right? So you don't see these 101-person votes except when there's a 50-50 tie. And so this was sort of fascinating. Obviously, it's an enormous public policy question. You know, what's going to become of, you know, the health insurance that people were delivered under Obamacare? And, you know, some people love it because it expanded the number of people covered. Some people don't like it because it sort of changed the way in which insurance is provided and rates have increased for some people. So there's a big fight over that. Procedurally, though, I mean, we're political scientists, and we're now moving to a segment in the class where institutions are going to become important. So the modules that you guys are going to be looking at, I think now we're doing presidency, yep, Congress, and Supreme Court as modules. This is a fascinating case study. You have a majority. Republicans have a slim majority, 53 votes, Republican votes in the Senate, 53 senators to 47. There are a couple of, Bernie Sanders is a, you know, Democratic socialist. He votes with the Democrats, yeah, right? So it's really 53 to 47. But the Republicans lost some of their senators on this. Senators, even though they're Republicans, said, I'm not down for this. And so McConnell basically got everybody except, was it Susan Collins he lost?
Yes.
Let's see, who else did he lose? He ended up getting Rand Paul on board. Now let's sort of diverge here for a second. What we ended up getting here, because you remember last week we were telling you the Republicans screwed this up, they didn't have the votes, right? Well, what changed? Well, they decided we're not going to vote for repeal and replace, because replacement meant you had to actually put another plan up on the board. And you had opposition from the right wing of the Republican Party, or I guess the sort of conservative libertarian wing, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul. And you had opposition from the moderate wing of the Republican Party, right? So, for instance, Lisa Murkowski in Alaska and Olympia Snow in Maine. So, you know, you got opposition from both sides. So what did they do? McConnell said, well, you know, we could just pull the whole thing and just say, hey, let Obamacare succeed or fail on its own. Or you can do what he did, and that was he said, all right, let's forget about replacing. Let's just have a straight up or down vote on repealing it. And so McConnell went back to the Senate. He said, we're just going to say, do you want Obamacare? And if he managed to get the votes, which he did, that means that if that passes, that's the basis for a reconciliation conference with the House. The House already passed a repeal and replace bill. So they were waiting for the Senate. If the Senate didn't do anything, it was dead. But if the Senate does anything, that can be the basis for a reconciliation conference between the House and the Senate, where they try to hammer out some kind of compromise. So McConnell put his reputation on the line. He managed to get people like Rand Paul and others to vote for repeal. He made some concessions. The Republicans did some interesting things. John Cornyn of Texas was kind of one of the main movers of this. They opened up debate and allowed amendments to the repeal initiative, right? And that was useful because then some senators got to put stuff on that they wanted on to protect themselves if they're running for re-election. It had the veneer of bipartisanship because they actually didn't shut down the possibility that Democrats would put amendments onto this thing. Democrats didn't really take the bait, but they offered it up. And that was kind of a smart move, as it turned out. So the Republicans had a couple votes that were away. If McCain had not been able to physically come to the Senate and cast a vote in favor of repealing, that bill would have gone down. So you imagine this emotional moment. McCain enters the chamber. Both sides give him a standing ovation. He casts a vote that makes it a tie. And then Mike Pence, who's presiding, casts the vote in favor of repeal. So does that mean we're repealing Obamacare? No, not at all. What it means, though, is that the Senate has a version of a health care reform bill. And that now will be the basis to allow the entire Congress, House and Senate, a conference to reconcile. So the Republicans who are majority in the House and the Republicans in the Senate will get together and try to figure out if they can do something that could pass the entirety of the House and Senate in a future vote. And that's kind of where we are. Is that a win? Well, it's a win in the sense that it's not a huge embarrassing political loss for the Republicans. It doesn't mean they won't muck it up down the road. What does it mean in terms of public policy? Not much right now. The markets and people like us, you know, you guys who have health insurance, we're kind of trying to figure out what all of this means. And the reality is we don't know. We don't know. And it's not clear that there's much of a basis for moving forward, but the Republicans are going to give it a shot. So at any rate, you know, that's gone down. Now the Republicans are going to move on to other things. And I don't know, analytically, I'll pose this to you guys out there. I mean, you know, it's tough for presidents to get things done the further they are in office, the deeper into your term they get, right? People start thinking about the midterm election. And so in some sense, people thought this was a, you know, Republicans had to deliver on their pledge to repeal, at least, if not replace Obamacare. Is that a good thing, or should they have done something else? You know, maybe got a couple of wins under their belt before they took on Obamacare. Was this the smart move on their part or not? I'll leave that to you all, but it's interesting analytically. Is this a victory or not? Should they have done things in a different way? Should they have done tax reform first and then moved on to health care? You know, these are the kinds of questions that people are a lot smarter than me, not Professor McDaniel, but me, get to answer. So anything else on the health care? Any postmortems, even though we're still in the middle of it?
No, I mean, it's just one of those things that just kind of keeps going on and on and on and on. So, I mean, if you think about a presidential campaign, how it starts, you know, the 2016 presidential campaign really started, you know, in 2013, and it just would not stop. This is kind of the same thing, and you're kind of left with, like, where are we now? Now, of course, you've got the Democrats who are trying to rouse their base, running around like Chicken Little. They're repealing Obamacare. They voted repeal. No, they didn't. They voted to have a discussion about repealing Obamacare. I mean, doesn't mean the activists still need to be out. Yeah, I guess in a way they need to make sure their voices are heard and see if you might be able to get one more senator to kind of to oppose it. But it's a lot of kind of running around, things like that. Now, in regards to something that where you actually are seeing movement is, if we move to the state of Texas, there is the vote on the bathroom bill. We're dealing with transgender individuals and basically where you have to use the bathroom of your assigned sex.
Right.
And there's been a great deal of pushback on this, specifically from the business community. So you have individuals such as Jerry Jones, others, who are basically saying, you know, if you do something like this, we may suffer a fate similar to what North Carolina faced, where the NCAA and the ACC pulled its tournaments out of the state, and there are millions of dollars lost. And so the ACC tournament was held in South Carolina, and many of the NCAA tournament games that would have been in North Carolina were moved to neighboring states. And so because of that, North Carolina didn't necessarily fully repeal, but kind of took some of the teeth out of the law that they had passed. Indiana faced the same problem. And so the question becomes, Indiana faced the same threats, and so they didn't move on it. So Governor Mike Pence, I think Vice President Mike Pence, basically backed up, so, okay, we need to rewrite this law. Now it's coming to Texas. And so you have a number of businesses basically saying, you know, if Texas is going to be doing this, we don't know if we're going to stay in the state of Texas. Also, you know, there's the fear that Texas may lose some sporting events. So if you think of Dallas and Houston as Super Bowl locations.
San Antonio's a Final Four next year.
Final Four. So Houston, Dallas, San Antonio's all Final Four locations. And so there's a lot of revenue that the cities could be losing. So the state may lose some, but again, this is an issue with the cities losing a lot of revenue. And given that there's kind of a fight between the rural area and rural and urban areas in the state, you know, it's not really clear to what degree if the city say, hey, we're going to lose money, people will actually react well to that.
This is a fascinating issue. It's merged, and, you know, just to kind of, again, add some specifics and clarity here, I mean, what's happened is that, you know, we've moved a long way on issues involving sexuality, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender rights. And, you know, I remember 15 years ago, gay marriage was extraordinarily controversial, and a huge majority of states passed laws, Defense of Marriage Acts, which define marriage as between a man and a woman. And public opinion moved very rapidly over 5 or 6 years in favor of, you know, marriage rights for gay and lesbian couples. It's extraordinary. We both Professor McDaniel and I study public opinion, and I don't know that I've ever seen an issue where opinion kind of moves so inexorably in a particular direction. But you know, if you talk to LGBTQ activists, they'll tell you in candid moments that the T part of that equation was always going to be the most difficult in terms of public opinion, moving people on transgender issues. Now, I don't know that we've seen a lot of movement on transgender issues. And the bathroom controversy is actually one that's tricky. I mean, we've had some people here at UT who are very, very strong in the LGBT community who aren't necessarily of the opinion that bathrooms ought to, you know, be a matter of, you know, attitudinal choice, that is, you know, the self-identification as opposed to birth identification. So it's tricky, but this has kind of been the issue on which both the conservative right as well as the transgender community have decided this is where they're going to lock horns. What's fascinating to me, though, is how framing has come into play here. Professor McDaniel and I will talk about framing with respect to the media and media effects, but it's also relevant for public opinion. How you define an issue can go a long way towards influencing public opinion. And this issue is increasingly, as Professor McDaniel said, being defined in the Texas context as having a strong economic dimension. Yeah. Right? So I don't know that what you're seeing is, and I would have predicted this bill was going to pass in January. Mm-hmm. Now it's on razor's edge whether or not this bill is going to pass. Now, the bill itself is, to be clear, a conservative response. It basically says, hey, bathrooms are for birth assignment. Right? But that may go belly up. That may not work. A lot of the schools who are the most affected, the public schools, they've come out and basically say that they don't see a problem with moving in the opposite direction. It doesn't really bother them very much. People have made sort of a safety issue with respect to young women, haven't been as forceful, haven't necessarily carried the day. And this economic issue, and particularly the example of North Carolina, has influenced people. So people who might ordinarily on social issue basis or religious grounds or safety grounds said, I'm not very comfortable with this, look at some of the people who aren't necessarily opposing and look at the economic impact. And, you know, so it's an issue that Republicans, I think, thought was a slam dunk. It ain't a slam dunk right now. And it's very divisive. If you go to the Capitol, lots of activity over there on both sides.
Yeah, and one of the things that Texas brags about is its strong economy. The fact that it's been able to bring in business from California, places of that nature. But the problem is when you bring in businesses from California, you also bring in kind of California ideals, things like that. I know Governor Abbott has complained that, you know, we're supposed to be Texas, we're not California. But the problem is when you bring people in from California, so they look more like California. And so it's going to be interesting to see if the tech companies are willing to stay in Texas given this. And the tech companies seem to be a little bit more progressive on these things. And so it's not just the issue of losing, I mean, sporting events, but also that the state may be seen as maybe friendly towards business interests in terms of low taxes, things of that nature, but unfriendly towards the people who will be working in those businesses. And so this becomes a bit of a weird issue there for Texas to try to maneuver through.
And California has actually, on the books, a law that says public companies, public entities cannot go to states that have what they consider discriminatory statutes or regulations. Yeah. And so they've already said, this, for instance, this is a minor example of this, But the University of California schools, so let's stick with athletics here for a second. UC Berkeley, the Golden Bears, UCLA, my old school, the Bruins. If they were to win a lot of football games, which is a major assumption for this year, and say merit an invitation to go to the Cotton Bowl, which is held in Dallas every year, University of California schools would not be allowed under current conditions and California's current interpretation of the Texas situation would not go, would forfeit or decline an invitation to go to the Cotton Bowl or the Texas Bowl or the Alamo Bowl, right? Now, they'll just find a replacement probably, but for other events, as Professor McDaniel said, the NCAA, which governs all college athletics, has basically signaled that they will pull. I think I misspoke. I think I said San Antonio has a Final Four next year. I think they have a regional final next year and then the Final Four in 2019. They basically said, you ain't getting that if this passes. And, you know, if you guys have ever been down to San Antonio or to Houston when they've got a major sporting event like that, it draws a lot of people from out of state, a lot of revenue, and Texas is loath to put that money at risk for something that the people who seem to be most immediately affected aren't necessarily all that interested in or think is that big a deal.
So if you think of Arizona when they wouldn't pass the MLK holiday, no Super Bowls. If you think of South Carolina when they still had the Confederate flag waving, a lot of people stayed away. And when they finally put it down, they started getting tournaments, things of that nature. So there is a clear shunning from certain business entities where they will like, you know what, we're not going to deal with you. And then also you may be say that the law in California is a bit weird, but Wisconsin actually had a law that said that none of its schools, none of its public schools could play against the team that used a Native American mascot. And that became a little bit of a fishy issue because, like, what about the Utah Utes, which is actually taken, you know, from the tribe or
with the tribe's blessing.
Yeah, the tribe. And so that became one of the big issues of, okay, how do we carry this out? But many states have said, you know what, if you're going to behave in this way, we don't want to interact with you. Our money will not go to your state.
Yeah. So at any rate, kind of fascinating developments. What else we got for this? A couple other stories we want to mention before we get you out of here.
So one of the big things that's becoming that's going on in this special session is there's a discussion of maternal death rates. And so what we're finding is that a number of women in the state of Texas, and actually Texas really has a very high level of women who die giving birth, and we find that this is twice as likely for black women. And so Texas right now is working on setting up a commission to study why this is going on. And you may say, well, why set up a commission? What am I making policy? Well, the problem is you need the commission to first understand what exactly is going on so you can create policy. But furthermore, evidence is found that if you have offices like commissions or like an office of minority health, you do find improvements in minority health. So specifically, there's evidence that when a state establishes an office of minority health, which again, really doesn't have lawmaking power, does not have regulatory power, but has the power to inform legislators and to collect information, inform legislators and inform agencies, you do see a decrease in infant mortality amongst racial minorities. And so taking a step into something like this is Texas's way really of trying to protect the goodwill and the fortunes of its citizens. One of the things that a state is required to do is protect its citizens, and if you find that there's a problem affecting a certain number of its citizens, that they need to step in and take action on this.
I got nothing on this one.
Yeah.
Texas is, you can kind of tell from the conversation both this week and previously, Texas is a fascinating state. It is a big, diverse state, racially, geographically, in terms of income, education, occupation, you know, it's rural, urban, it's really tremendously diverse and interesting. And one of the things that I find fascinating is, you know, you go to places in the Northeast and, you know, for instance, African-American populations tend to be very residentially concentrated. You know, places like New York or even, you know, I'm from San Diego. And in San Diego, you know, the African-American population historically has been concentrated in a few areas. In Texas, there's a little bit of that, you know, South Dallas and areas in Houston. But it's the African-American population is much more diverse. There are rural African-Americans in the state of Texas as well. It's not just South Dallas. It's not just, you know, urban in Houston. They're sprinkled through East Texas. And so, you know, it's interesting when you get these sorts of findings to ask yourself as an analyst, what's going on here? Is it purely race? Is it residential location, urban, rural? Is it income slash education? In other words, is a socioeconomic status effect going on here? And these sorts of factors are even more complicated in Texas than other places because there's so many different factors. You know, if I go to San Diego, I say, well, I'll control for socioeconomic status, and if I still find a race effect, there's a race effect. Well, in Texas, you got, and Professor McDaniel's sort of the king of this, you got 5, 6, 7 control variables, other possible explanations that can go into this, and it makes the story complicated. But, you know, we think of the United States as being kind of the ultimate developed country, the ultimate first world country. And sometimes in some places, that's not quite the way it is, and we still have a ways to go, obviously. So you got one more story, I got one more story, right?
Yeah, so I guess the last one dealing with Texas is, as many of you are aware, it is hot out there. It is oppressively hot. And in many Texas prisons, they do not provide air conditioning to their prisoners. However, federal judges ruled that Texas prisons must provide air conditioning to certain inmates. And so they were denying it to kind of inmates across the board. And so the federal courts have ruled that this is a violation of their civil rights, maybe more to argue human rights, by not providing individuals with certain health conditions with air conditioning.
See, I just like the notion of, it's much more serious than this, obviously, but air conditioning as a civil right.
Yep.
I would have laughed about that growing up in San Diego. Now that I'm in Texas, air conditioning is a fundamental freedom as far as I'm concerned. All right, I've got one extra one too, and this is even more localized. And this kind of refers to, it's a public policy issue, but I want to strip that out a little bit. What I want to focus on is media coverage of the public policy issues. So here's an article that appeared Sunday in the Austin American-Statesman. By the way, for those of you who don't recognize, this is what we call a newspaper. All right, a newspaper. I think there's 4 or 5 of them still left in the United States. Okay, so you see the headline, 4 UT gun incidents reported in year. All right, so that's the teaser. So I wake up on Sunday morning, I'm like, wow, this is interesting. I need to figure this out, right? 4 gun incidents. Well, a couple problems I have with the reporting.
with these 4?
On this. Okay, the first is 4 a lot historically? Is it not a lot? Obviously the context here is the conceal and carry law that was passed. Has it produced more gun incidents or fewer gun or no effect? Well, I don't know because they don't report on the number of gun incidents in any other year. Okay, so all I got is 4. And I'm thinking, okay. I read the article. The article says, well, only one of the incidents is related to conceal and carry. I thought, oh, okay. So there's a gun incident related to conceal and carry. What was it? Well, okay, they describe all 4 incidents. And the one that they argue was related to conceal and carry was a New York Times reporter was doing a report on this law and was asking students, do you have a gun? Do you have a concealed gun? And they asked a bunch of students. Finally, they found a student who said, yes, I have a gun. They said, well, can we see it? And he proceeded to produce the gun. Well, that was reported as a gun incident. So that was the one related to concealed. Now, by the way, I want to make it clear. I'm not espousing a view one way or the other on the law. That's not my job, certainly not in this class. But that was the one gun incident. I thought, so New York Times reporter is doing a report on it, ask people to produce a gun, and he says, sure, here's the gun that I have, and they said, gun incident. I'm not sure that really qualifies, but my favorite amongst these incidents was, so this is good, so I thought, well, what about the other 3? They said, these are 3 other incidents, they're not related to conceal and carry, but they're gun incidents at UT. So this is one of them. About 2 p.m. May 18th, police pursued a vehicle after a passenger pointed a handgun out of the window at 38th and Lamar. Now, most of you guys are pretty familiar with the campus at this point. 38th and Lamar is nowhere near UT. Professor McDaniel and I were looking at this. Maybe they were coming towards UT, or they were a UT student, and said, well, so they lost track of the vehicle at 51st Street and Avenue F. Police joined the search, but did not find the vehicle or the passengers. How this is a UT gun episode, again, it's reported as a UT gun episode. There must have been something that wasn't in the report, but I would just encourage you guys, this is just an example of when you read something online, when you read something in a newspaper, when you hear a report, dig a little deeper. I don't know that my observations here inform my view about the conceal and carry. It's just seems to me kind of contentious reporting and classification. One of the things Professor McDaniel and I have said is that when you get trained as a social scientist, and we keep pounding on you guys, and we do want to make sure we impart this to you throughout the semester, you know, think for yourselves, demand evidence, amass facts, build arguments to sustain opinions, right? And be open to the possibility you're wrong and to revise those things. And one of the things that drives us crazy is sloppy reporting, contentious reporting. And so you know, when someone says, hey, there were four gun incidents at UT, well, one of them was a 38th and Lamar, one of them was from a New York Times report, you know, one of them was in Guadalupe in 23rd. This is not to say there aren't important incidents, it's just to say, okay, how many of these are UT gun incidents? This is simply a criticism of sort of sometimes how we look at and classify data more than it is a public policy comment. So that's my comment for the day. Be careful about what you read and be a discerning consumer of political information. That's all I'm saying.
And we're not saying this is fake news, but we're saying that this is news that's out of context. And so...
And they present, to their credit, to the statesman's credit, they present facts. And my guess is that these are all classified by the university as gun incidents. Yeah. And I'm not disputing that. But in this case, we all have a particular interest because we all live here, work here. You know, these are interesting, and it raises questions about, you know, if someone just says four. I guess I'll give you another example. This last weekend, we had this dust from Africa that came over. You guys might have noticed this Saturday or Sunday, especially if you've got asthma or a condition like that. I remember in 2000, Governor Bush at the time had asked the Clinton administration. They had fires in Mexico that produces unbelievable smoke, and it just produces smog for days in Texas. And I think it was actually 1997. And in 1999, when the EPA days came out, the EPA classifies days with unhealthy conditions. The Bush people in the governor's office asked the EPA, can you please reclassify or get those off of our record? Those were produced by fires in Mexico, had nothing to do with Texas smog or pollution. And the EPA said no. And if you ask yourself, well, why would the EPA deny that? Well, Bush was gearing up for a run for the White House in 2000. The EPA was controlled by the Clinton administration, and they were kind of favoring Al Gore's run for the presidency. And so, lo and behold, the next year they say, wow, in 1997, there were 23 days in Texas where, you know, they had smoggy conditions. You know, Bush's environmental record is really awful. And I remember thinking, okay, that's an interesting way to classify the data. So even though we love data, we're empirical at heart, always be discerning about when you get this information. And again, we're not saying fake news or talking about conspiracy theories, but use your minds, use your common sense when it comes to, you know, receiving data. Be critically discriminating, not criminally. Okay. Critically discriminating when you get evidence, even from even stuff that we say. We'll present data all the time, and we're open to challenges, and, you know, maybe because we're political scientists, we're really open to the possibility that, yeah, we made decisions about classifying data or, you know, what our time points are, things like that. You know, ask us about that, and we'll walk you through the process. That's an important part of your college education.
Yeah, and again, one thing that's very important to note is whenever this stuff comes out, there's a lot of context involved that's important to be aware of. So there was the report about CTE with brain scans of former NFL players.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things about this is like, look, okay, there's certain players that were willing. So they don't have every single NFL player. They don't have every player that played football. There are certain things you need to be aware of where they find, like, look, 90% of them had CTE. Now, there's another study that came out that was a longitudinal study of Wisconsin and said, you know, it really doesn't seem to be a problem. Now, again, if you read the study, the authors probably wrote in like, look, our study is limited because of A, B, C, and D. But the problem is when it's reported, it's not reported. It's like, oh, here are their findings without accounting for all the limitations. And so we're very careful to talk about the limitations, whereas with journalists, they aren't so easy with that. But then again, going back to universities and crime statistics, is that the federal government requires them to report these things. However, there's sometimes there are crimes that happen that aren't on campus, but are on streets neighboring campus. So for instance, Temple in Philadelphia is in an urban area. And the problem is there's a street bordering Temple where there seems to be a significant amount of crime. And Temple is constantly fighting to not have those crimes reported because it makes Temple's campus look more unsafe than it actually is.
My son's at Georgia Tech, which is in downtown Atlanta, same sort of situation.
Yeah, and so again, it's important to be aware of these things and really ask a follow-up question. So, okay, four incidents, okay, was that up or is that down? Again, the follow-up question is extremely important, and I think that also demonstrates how you're discerning, but also that you're not just taking information just for face value. And this will actually, I think this will make it better when you evaluate candidates, when you evaluate policy, but when you evaluate things in general in life, just get a little more context about these things.
Yeah, and also we're kind of big on uncertainty. The more you read from the psychology literature, and certainly it's pretty humbling on your political scientists these days, One of the things that people, I think, really didn't like about the 2016 coverage of the 2016 election, and I think political science bears some responsibility for this, is how certain we all seemed to be about what was going to happen. And, you know, if there's any discipline where you need to take into account uncertainty, it should be political science, because, you know, we study power and we study human attempts to accumulate and manipulate power. And, you know, there are a lot of factors that we can't quite account for sometimes.
It's like an episode of Game of Thrones.
You got it.
You like, what? Did not see that coming. And guess what? that's the world we live in.
All right. That's all for this week then. We'll see you next time and have a good weekend. Stay cool. Use your right to AC.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.